Good evening, everyone, and thank you, Fiona, for that introduction. After so many webinars and Zoom meetings and WebEx meetings, it's really great to be able to be here in person with a room full of people. And Fiona, contrary to my remarks 2 years ago, I'm really looking forward to the day when this room is full of people. Actually, I'm more looking forward to being in Melbourne again and be able to speak to a room full of CEDA members down in Melbourne. As we all know, 2020 has been a year like no other, and it's one that we'll never forget. We've had a global pandemic, the closure of our borders, the biggest economic downturn in nearly a century, very, very large budget deficits, interest rates down to zero, and quantitative easing by the Reserve Bank of Australia. That's quite a list, isn't it? And no items on this list were expected at the beginning of the year. Unfortunately, it guarantees that 2020 will be a year that's talked about for decades to come. Yet through these difficult times, the underlying strengths of the Australian economy and the Australian people have been on display. Our economy has performed better than most other countries in very challenging circumstances. We've had more success in containing the virus than most other countries. Australia's public institutions have worked effectively and constructively together. Our public sector balance sheets are strong, and they've been used to very good effect to cushion the shock. And our financial institutions have also helped people and businesses manage their mortgages and their debts. And Australians across the country have reacted sensibly, and they've worked together to contain the virus. So even though we have had our challenges and our setbacks, we do have a lot to be thankful for in this country, and I think it's important we remember that. Notwithstanding this, a year like the one we're living through will inevitably leave some marks on our economy and on our approach to economic policy, including monetary policy. And tonight I'd like to talk about some of these marks. In terms of the economy, I'm going to touch on five issues where the pandemic is leaving its clear effects. The first, it has brought to an end Australia's nearly three-decade-long run without a recession. It was an impressive record, and it's one that will not be easily broken by us or by others. We are, though, now having to adjust to a new reality, and you can see this from my first chart. The level of output in Australia has fallen by a record 7% in the June quarter, and over 2020, we're expecting GDP to decline by around 4%. In the RBA's central scenario, we're expecting growth of 5% next year and 4% in 2020. These are certainly fast growth rates, but because the size of the fall in the first half of the year has been so large, it will take until the end of 2021, the end of next year, for us to reach the level of output that we obtained at the end of last year. The downturn has taken a heavy toll on our labour market, and you can see this in my next chart. Hours worked in Australia fell by 10% between March and May, and the unemployment rate now stands at 6.9%, and underemployment's even higher. We're expecting the unemployment rate to rise further over the next few months to a little below 8% later in the year. In our central scenario, we expect the unemployment rate to then start gradually declining, but the unemployment rate still expected to be above 6% at the end of 2022. One consequence of this higher unemployment is that wages and prices pressures are likely to remain subdued for quite some time. In each of the next 2 years, we're expecting annual wage growth of less than 2%. It's a very low number. And inflation in underlying terms is expected to be just 1% next year and 1.5% in 2022. Again, very low numbers. It's certainly possible that the economy will do better than this baseline scenario. The recent data have on balance been better than expected, and the easing of restrictions has lifted spirits right across the country. And further good news on a vaccine or on rapid testing would also obviously be helpful. There is a lot of stimulus in the system at the moment. Balance sheets are generally in good shape, and governments are providing substantial incentives for firms to invest and employ people. So if we do get further good news on the health front, we could have quite a rapid rebound. At the same time, it's still possible that we experience further outbreaks, and I think the news in South Australia today is a reminder of that. And it's also possible that the hoped-for medical advances may be delayed, and they could face production and distribution challenges, slowing their rollout. So this means that there continue to be significant downside scenarios as well. So there is still a lot of uncertainty about the future. It does, though, seem highly probable that one of the marks the pandemic will leave in our economy is an extended period of higher unemployment than we became used to over the past decade or so. Addressing this higher rate of unemployment is an important national priority. A second area where the pandemic has left a mark is the sharp decline in population growth, which you can see here. Over the past two decades, Australia's population grew at an average rate of around 1.5% per year. But in 2021, population growth is expected to be just 0.2%. This will be the slowest rate of increase since 1916, when many Australians left our shores to fight in World War I. The fast population growth of recent decades has been a major factor shaping our economy. It's underpinned our relatively fast growth in GDP compared to other countries. It's slowed the ageing of the population, given that many of the new arrivals have been fairly young, and the large number of students coming to Australia has boosted our education sector. And the effects of fast population growth have also been felt in our housing market and in pressure on some of our infrastructure. So the effects of the fast population growth have been widespread. Looking to the future, I think it remains hard to predict when the borders will open up again, and when they do, what the rate of new arrivals will be. If population growth is to be noticeably slower in a post-COVID world, the trajectory of our economy will look quite different too. A third area where the pandemic is having a marked effect is on our property market. It's a pretty complex picture at the moment, with the market simultaneously adjusting to a recession, to lower population growth, record low interest rates, substantial government incentives to support residential construction, and changes in the way that we work, live and shop. So there are a lot of moving pieces in the property market at the moment, and the effects are very uneven across the economy, and they're very uneven across different types of property. The effects of the pandemic are most obvious in the market for retail properties, especially in our CBDs. Vacancy rates there have increased very sharply, as you can see. Not surprisingly, rents and capital values of CBD retail properties have also fallen substantially. There's also been an impact in the CBD office market as people work from home. The national office vacancy rate has increased sharply this year, and further increases are expected. But even here, there's considerable variation across our cities, with the biggest increases in CBD office vacancies in Sydney and Melbourne. In contrast to the office market, the markets for industrial property have been stronger, with increased demand for warehousing and distribution facilities arising as people increasingly shop online. The residential market's also a pretty mixed picture. Our biggest cities have been more affected than others by the slowdown in population growth. They've also been more directly affected by the virus. And as a result, prices in Sydney and Melbourne have fallen in recent months, while they've risen in most other cities. It's also noteworthy that in some states, the markets in our regional towns and cities have been stronger than the markets in our capital cities. For example, I think as you can see in this chart, prices have fallen in Sydney recently, but they've increased in regional New South Wales. There's a broadly similar pattern in Victoria. Many regional centres have been less affected by the virus, and some are experiencing increased demand for property as people work remotely and look for property outside our biggest cities. But within the capital cities, the markets for houses and apartments are also performing quite differently. In most cities, and again especially in Sydney and Melbourne, rents for apartments are now falling, while rents for houses are generally rising. The apartment markets are more affected by the lower population growth and by fewer foreign students coming to Australia, and by young Australians staying at home or with their parents. There's also been an increase in demand for houses as people work from home. So as I said, it's a complex picture, and the full effects of the pandemic will take time to be evident in our property markets. To date, though, the demand from investors in residential property has been quite subdued. But it's certainly possible that low interest rates will change this. So this is one of the many areas that we'll be watching carefully over the months ahead. The fourth area where the pandemic is likely to leave a mark is on our attitude to risk. While it's not possible to be definitive here, I expect that for a time, people will be more cautious in their borrowing and spending decisions. As we all know, 2020 has been a very sobering year. Given this, it's probable that some people will want bigger buffers in the future to guard against future shocks. I think many people will also be less inclined to lever up, and they'll be more cautious on taking on debts. At the same time, though, it is important that we guard against becoming too risk-averse. Over the past decade or so, there have been signs that our economy has become less dynamic. An increase in risk aversion would reinforce this unhelpful trend. As we all know, businesses need to take risks to innovate and to grow. I understand that in an uncertain world, it can be hard to take on risk, and there can be a natural tendency to avoid new risks and expansion. But if businesses are to seize the opportunities that are out there to grow and to increase Australia's productive capital base, some degree of risk-taking is necessary. So we do need to guard against becoming too risk-averse. Another area that we'll be watching carefully is how people adjust their portfolios as they search for yield in a low interest rate world. Some people will no doubt move out along the risk spectrum. And as they do that, the additional investment risk will need to be understood and managed. It's important we do that well. A fifth area where the pandemic is leaving a mark is in the digitalisation of our economy. In some areas, progress that otherwise would have taken years has been made in a matter of months. The combination of necessity, of new technologies, and the easing of some regulations has made a real difference here. Digitalisation is not only helping Australians deal with the pandemic right now, but it will also boost productivity and it can help drive future economic growth. Examples of this include the uptake of telehealth and the availability of electronic prescriptions. Companies can now hold AGMs virtually, and they can sign legal documents electronically. Many people are also benefiting from not having to travel to as much for work and for meetings. For some, the time that would have otherwise been spent sitting in a car or on public transport or on a plane can be used for more productive or for more rewarding activities. As you can see from this next chart, there's also been very rapid growth in online retailing, with many people shopping online for the first time. Reflecting this, online retail sales have increased by 80%. It's a large number, 80% since the start of the year. The shift to doing things differently is also evidenced in the payments data, where there's been a marked increase in the use of electronic payments. One side effect of this is that the use of banknotes for transactions has declined very considerably. As you can see here, the value of cash withdrawals has fallen by 17% this year, and again, I expect this trend to continue. This acceleration in the shift to a more digital economy is prompting firms to innovate and to find new ways of doing things. Firms are having to compete to come up with new products and new ways of delivering them. This innovation and this competition will have a positive long-run payoff for our economy. It will take time to realise the full benefits of this innovation and this competition. But as businesses are re-engineered to become more digital, we will see the benefits in terms of higher productivity and, in time, higher economic growth. On that positive note, I'd now like to turn to economic policy, where there have been major changes too. On the fiscal front, fiscal policy has taken on a greater role in macroeconomic stabilisation than was the case prior to the pandemic. It's entirely appropriate it's done this, and it reflects the size and nature of the shock we've been living through and the limits on monetary policy in a low interest rate world. This change has been accompanied by a shift in the government's broader fiscal strategy. The first stage of the revised strategy is to support the economy and jobs and promote economic growth until a recovery is assured. And this focus will remain in place until the unemployment rate is comfortably below 6%. In a way, this is a form of forward guidance that is familiar to central banks. In the longer run, the strategy will focus on stabilising and then reducing debt as a share of GDP. In doing this is important. It will provide greater flexibility to respond to future shocks, wherever they come from. The key here is to ensure a strong economy. So I think it's important, and I know this is CETA's focus as well, to focus on the reforms and the innovations that will deliver a strong economy. I think that in time will help us deal with the increased debt we've taken on to deal with the pandemic. There have also been changes on the monetary policy front, and I want to highlight four of them. The first is the nature of the RBA's own forward guidance. In the past, our forward guidance about interest rates was forward-looking. We focused on the outlook or the forecast for inflation. This was a sensible approach when the inflation dynamics were stable, they were well understood and predictable. But the combination of globalisation and technology and now the pandemic have changed these dynamics. Labour markets are clearly working differently to the way they used to work, and the wage and inflation dynamics have changed. This has made relying on forecasts much more difficult. Given this, we have now moved to place much more weight on actual outcomes rather than forecast outcomes in our decision making and in our forward guidance. As an example of this, in our communication after the most recent board meeting, we said, and here I quote, "The board will not increase the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the 2-3% target range. For this to occur, wages growth will have to be materially higher than it currently is. This will require significant gains in employment and a return to a tight labour market." So this type of forward guidance is in contrast to our early approach, which emphasised our expectation of future inflation or the forecast for inflation. We're much more focused today on actual outcomes. The second and related change that I want to talk about has been a shift in the relative weight given to jobs and inflation in our communication. The mandate of the Reserve Bank of Australia was established by Parliament back in 1959, and the central elements of that mandate have remained unchanged since then. Our mandate is to promote price stability, full employment, and the economic welfare of the Australian people. This mandate is broader than that given to most other central banks in the world, with Australia not having swung with the fashion over recent decades to give the central bank a mandate solely focused on inflation. My view is that this broader mandate has served the country well, and it's especially relevant in times like the ones we're living through now. In particular, the challenge facing Australia over the next few years is much more likely to be the creation of jobs rather than controlling inflation pressures. So that's our focus too. The board wants to do what it can with the tools that it has to support the national effort to reduce unemployment. This does not mean that we're backing away from the inflation target. As Australia's central bank, we will continue to provide a strong nominal anchor through the 2-3% medium-term flexible inflation target. And we remain committed to achieving that target. But the best way to do this is through reducing the spare capacity that currently exists in our economy. And this starts with getting people back into jobs. If we can help do that, we'll get closer to full employment and get closer to the inflation target, and we will enhance the economic welfare of the Australian people. The third change to monetary policy that I want to talk about is a strengthening of the gravitational pull of low global interest rates. A decade ago, world real interest rates fell sharply in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. Around the world, after the financial crisis, people wanted to save more and they wanted to invest less. The inevitable result of more savings and less investment is a fall in the return to savers. Given that Australia is part of the interconnected global financial system, we felt the effects of this here too. Even so, our interest rates did not fall after the global financial crisis as much as they did elsewhere, due to the combination of the resources boom, our relatively strong economy, and higher levels of investment in Australia. They fell, but they didn't fall as far. This year, the pandemic has brought another major shock, particularly to investment intentions, which have fallen further. As a result, global interest rates and the return to savers have also fallen further. The gravitational pull of this on our own interest rates has been very strong. The RBA has responded to this, with the policy rate in Australia now effectively at zero, as it is in many other countries. If we had sought to ignore this gravitational pull, there would have been obvious consequences for our exchange rate and for our economy. If our interest rates were higher than in the major countries, there would be stronger inflows into Australian dollar assets, and this would have put upward pressure on the value of the Australian dollar. And in turn, this would have made it harder to make the needed progress on jobs. Over the medium term, I do expect to see a time when Australia's strong economic conditions again justify higher interest rates. But today, during a global pandemic, when a lot of people have lost their jobs and many businesses are struggling, is not the time for that. It will have to wait. The fourth and final change on the monetary front is the return to a world in which quantities, not just prices, matter. Over recent decades, monetary policy has been about the price of money, the short-term interest rate. Relatively little attention was paid to the quantity of money. This too has now changed, with the RBA now undertaking quantitative easing, or QE, as many other central banks have done. I think we all know that quantities and prices are connected, so QE works partly through affecting the price of money, including long-term risk-free interest rates. But there are other effects too. When the central bank increases the quantity of money and buys assets, liquidity in the financial system is increased, and investors in the private sector need to purchase other assets with the proceeds of the funds that they've obtained by selling their bonds to the central bank. These portfolio adjustments affect the price of other assets, and they affect international capital flows, and they affect the exchange rate. We're still learning about how strong and durable these transmission mechanisms are from QE, and we will learn more over the coming months as we implement our own $100 billion QE program. So there's been a lot of change in our economy and a lot of change in monetary policy since I last spoke to the CETA annual dinner. Let's hope the next 2 years are not as volatile. But to conclude, 2020 has been a year of great change and a year of great disruption for us all. I'm sure everyone in this room is talking about issues that we didn't even contemplate at the start of the year. Australia is managing very well in these challenging circumstances, and I expect it to continue to do so. The pandemic has been difficult for many people and businesses, but we are now on the road to the recovery. As we travel along that road, we will see some changes in our economy, and we'll see new opportunities as well, and we need to take some risks to seize those opportunities. As we make that journey, economic policy will continue to adjust to our changing circumstances. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for being in the room tonight. I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
The questions are flooding in, but can I start with a quick one first before I seek to decipher these? 2 years ago when you gave your CETA address, it was all about trust, and you talked about the importance of our community having high levels of trust in public institutions and in business, and that that was key to economic development. And there was a lot of very polite concern expressed on your part about the level of trust at that time. And yet today we have a somewhat different story emerging. There's this language of Team Australia and public institutions having risen to the challenge and government having done the right thing. And in a lot of your recent speeches you've been talking about cooperation. And have we fixed the trust issue, and are we done on that? And it seems to be a very optimistic way to describe the pandemic experience.
No, I don't think we're done on that, but adversity does bring out the best in people, doesn't it? I think we've seen the political class do a pretty good job. Our public institutions have performed well, and the banks have come to the party. They've given these loan deferrals. They're helping people in difficult circumstances. So adversity does bring out the best in people, and we've seen that in Australia. People come together in a way that we'd hoped would happen, but weren't sure whether it would, but it actually has, we've come together, and as you say, Team Australia has done a very good job, and the country's benefiting from that. I think Australians have come together as well. We've accepted the restrictions on our liberty better than I thought we might have. I remember back in February when we saw the lockdowns in some countries, including China, people saying that couldn't work in our democracy. But Australians, with the leadership that we've had from the political class, have accepted this, and we've come together and done the right thing. None of that removes the underlying importance of trust. As I talked about 2 years ago, trust is kind of the binding agent for a kind of an open economic system. So businesses and banks and government, the central bank needs to keep earning trust, and I think we're more appreciative of that than we were 2 years ago. And because I'm optimistic by nature, I'm hopeful that the experience we're living through will show the community that the institutions, government, actually can be trusted to do the right thing by the people, and we've got to keep earning that. So it's, I look for the upside in everything, and one of the upsides here is that we've shown the community that we can do the right thing and look after the collective interest. We can build on that.
So when you say we can build on that, part of what you talked about tonight was the period of uncertainty immediately ahead, and uncertainty is always problematic. So how can we build on that optimism that you've just described to mitigate some of the potential downside of fearing the future?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. There's a lot of uncertainty about the future. We can focus on that. We can also focus on the resilience of the system and the opportunities that we now have. I mean, it's been remarkable that in a matter of 6 months we've got two or three vaccines that are in advanced stages of their development. People thought this could take years. But when our scientists put their mind to things, they can actually come up with solutions. So I'm encouraged by that, and it's uncertain about what happens next year, but it's quite plausible that a vaccine becomes widely available and we can start to get back to normal sometime over the next couple of years. So we've got to be realistic, but on the other hand, you know, there's a fair chance that the scientists actually can pull this off. The other thing that I think is a point of optimism is the digitalisation of our economy. I know many organisations, including my own, have been trying to do things differently for a long time, but we were struggling, and then years of progress is made in a short period of time. And I see renewed energy by business to do things differently, and hopefully that process leads to more innovation, I think more competition. And why I made remarks about kind of not being overly risk averse, because I see tremendous opportunity out there. We've got to seize it, and we can't kind of become too kind of pessimistic about looking at the past 6 months, and it's been very difficult. But there's a better path forward here, and we've got to seize it.
Well, I for one share your optimism, and I'm sure everyone in the room, with the exception of this gentleman who sent in a question, also shares your optimism. But Ken Morrison has asked, where can Australia's economic growth possibly come from through 2021 and beyond without the contribution of population growth?
Well, lower population growth does mean slower nominal and real GDP growth. Our population, as I said, has been growing at 1.5% a year, so that's fed right through directly into faster nominal GDP, real GDP growth than we otherwise would have had. So if we're going to have slower population growth, then we are going to have lower growth in GDP. It doesn't mean we're going to have lower growth in per capita GDP necessarily, but we will have lower nominal and real GDP growth. So where does growth come from? There's a lot of stimulus in the system at the moment. Interest rates are as low as they've ever been. They're going to stay low. The government has injected a lot of liquidity and cash into the system. It's creating substantial incentives for businesses to invest in and hire people. There are very significant stimulus measures in the housing residential construction market at the moment. So there's a lot of stimulus in the system. People's balance sheets are in pretty good shape as well. The saving rate in the national accounts in the June quarter was 20%. We've never seen anything like that before. So the government gave people a lot of money. We couldn't spend it because there were restrictions, but we're also more cautious, so we saved a lot. So my hope is that if we get reasonable news on the health front, that people have the confidence to spend that money that they've saved up, their balance sheets are in a better position, and with all the stimulus in the system, that will be enough to get the economy growing again and bouncing back. But it was my final point here. It does depend upon the health situation. We're seeing now in Europe the devastating effects of second, or maybe in some countries third waves. In Europe, they grew in the September quarter. In the December quarter, they're going to contract again because they didn't keep the virus under control. So if we can keep the virus under control with the stimulus in the system and the good balance sheets, I think we can come back strongly.
Thank you. Okay. I have a few more questions here, please, Philip. First one. There's a question here about, I think this is referring to the 3 November announcement, the historic rate cut and the quantitative easing intervention. Reference here to that intervention being without precedent. Some worry the economic shock when it unwinds will be equally unprecedented. So what do you say to these concerns? I'm not quite sure what that question is saying. I can guess, or perhaps you'd like to guess.
No, I don't really want to guess. Is it right, this was an unprecedented. We've had two kind of major policy packages this year. Both have been unprecedented. But I'm not sure what, as long as there's a question here, they can ask, kind of elaborate what their concerns are. I don't want to manufacture concerns.
No, well that's consistent with your optimistic paradigm. Is it saying that if all those other things take place that you've referred to, an imminent medical solution and a conflation of other positive factors, will the measures taken on 3 November have unintended consequences, which you might not be happy about? I mean, isn't that code for saying what would it do to inflation?
Yeah, well, I think there are two... there are two possibilities if I'm kind of in the world of manufacturing potential problems. One is inflation picking up too quickly and us being surprised at it. It's possible, but I think it's incredibly unlikely. For inflation to become a problem, I think wage growth has to be kind of 3.5, 4. In what state of the world does anyone think wage growth is going to be 4% in the next couple of years in Australia? I'm happy it can start with a 2. Our forecast is it starts with a 1. So things would have to change very, very dramatically for wages growth to be rising at 3.5 or 4 and be causing an inflation problem. It doesn't have a zero probability, but it's very, very small. I think the other concern that sometimes people raise is the possibility that asset prices rise a lot because of the very low interest rates, and particularly housing prices rise a lot. Again, that's possible, but I don't think it's particularly likely because of the population dynamics. The rental vacancy rates for residential property at the moment, particularly apartments in Sydney and Melbourne, is rising very, very quickly, and rents are falling. They're the weakest they've been in decades. So rents are falling, very high vacancy rates, lower population growth. So I think those underlying forces on demand are going to keep price growth relatively low. I also expect that people will be a bit more cautious about borrowing than they were in the past. You know, so you can't rule out asset prices rising too quickly, but I think again it's a fairly low probability event. And if it does happen and borrowing picks up too quickly, we know from the experience of the last couple of years that macroprudential instruments that APRA exercises can be effective in slowing the build-up of debt.
While we're talking around inflation, can I ask a question unrelated to COVID and one that should have been posed, you know, pre-pandemic? Having heard you speak so many times and having heard your hope, another optimistic hope, that inflation would start creeping up, we all start to wonder why it's such an intractable problem and whether or not there's something wrong with economic orthodoxy such that we just can't seem to get it up where you want it.
I don't know. I mean, we basically, inflation comes from the balance between supply and demand.
Yep.
I think we know that, and I'm confident that those basic laws of economics work, and I can see that operating in the economy right now. There's been very strong increases in grocery prices for the past 6 months. Why is that? Very strong demand. As people shop, you know, and cook at home. There's been the fastest rate of increase in homeware prices in a long time. Why is that? People are sitting at home doing online shopping and improving their houses. In the rental market, the rents are the weakest in decades. Why is that? The vacancy rate's very high and there's a lot of property and not many people going to it. So the underlying laws of supply and demand still work. Having said that, we have had trouble getting inflation back to target for a number of years, and I think this comes down to the way the labour market's operating. The fundamentals in labour markets, I think, have changed in many, many countries. You saw this in the United States as well. They got the unemployment rate down to kind of low fours, and it still wasn't generating inflation pressures. I think we all, and I've spoken about this on other occasions, I think up until the pandemic and presumably the case now, we all feel like there's more competition out there. And that comes because of globalisation technology. Jobs that could have been done in this great city can now be done anywhere around the world, and we all know that. So the combination of globalisation technology has changed the wage dynamics, and so even when we get quite low unemployment rates, we don't get wages picking up and inflation doesn't pick up. So it really comes back to the operation of the labour market, and this is why, well, one of the reasons in our communication we've been focusing on the importance of getting the unemployment rate down, people back into jobs, and wage growth picking up. So we've got to keep chipping away at that, I think. But the underlying supply-demand dynamics still work. We've just got to create more demand for labour relative to the supply of labour.
No, but as long as you're still optimistic about the theory, that's important. Look, I have a question from CEDA's chairman, Diane, and it is as follows. The Western Australian housing market seems to be displaying a different dynamic. Are you considering the state of the West?
We certainly are, and we have a team in Perth that talks to businesses in Perth and actually in the regional centres as well. And what we're hearing at the moment is some businesses are having trouble getting workers with the right skills. There's an obvious solution to that. Whether it's sensible, it comes with other costs, but there's an obvious solution to that. There are very large incentives for residential construction. The biggest incentives in the country are in Western Australia. And that's affecting the housing market there. So we're in close contact with businesses there, and Western Australia is doing very well at the moment.
I have a question here. I don't know if you wish to answer this. It's to what extent do you expect the trade tensions between Australia and China to have a big impact on our economy in the coming year?
Well, it's a very good question. I don't have a crystal ball on that. I'd observe that the Chinese economy is growing quite strongly at the moment. It's bounced back more quickly than any other economy. And once again, that's to Australia's advantage. Commodity prices are higher than they otherwise would be because the Chinese economy is doing quite well. And the fact that commodity prices are higher, exports are doing better, and actually government revenue is going to be better. So once again, we're benefiting from that. There are certainly issues in some particular product lines, and we've all got to hope that they go away. What happens there? It's very important it works out well, but I don't have a crystal ball, I'm sorry.
Well, this is a complete change of pace. Do you have any concerns about the ability of pension funds and superannuation funds to deliver on annuity products given the record low rates?
Do I have any concerns? It's certainly harder, isn't it? It's an issue that affects not just the annuity funds, but many Australians who put their money into bank deposits and rely on the interest income are finding it very, very difficult. And I think today I got another 5 letters reminding me of the difficulty that many people are experiencing. So I'm not so concerned about the annuity funds. I'm concerned more about the people who are relying on low interest rates, and they're not getting the income that they used to get. I think it's an issue. And it's something that we discuss a lot, and the Reserve Bank Board talks a lot about the difficult situation that those people are in.
Question here, if the key driver of business investment is rising demand, and we need to boost exports and consumer confidence, is Australia sufficiently competitive? And are policy settings appropriate to ensure our competitiveness?
Well, that's a very broad question. And I think my answer here is we can always do better. We're doing pretty well, but we can always do better, can't we? We can always be more competitive, more innovative, and the policy settings can be dialed up. So beyond that general response, I don't think I've got anything else to offer.
Well, this is a very personal question. Are you ready for this? You've described the year as a year like no other, but was there a particular moment, perhaps early in the crisis, when you had your greatest fear about the pandemic and the devastating economic fallout? What was the moment when you thought, this could be much more serious than I feared.
The moment that I remember most clearly is being in Saudi Arabia, of all places, with the treasurer at a G20 meeting. And on the first day of that meeting, the IMF was saying, look, China's got the virus, it's kind of starting to get it under control, it should be okay. And on the second day of the meeting, we heard that the virus was in South Korea, Iran, and Italy. And on one day, all those three countries had announced lockdown. And I thought, gee, if that was happening in three such diverse economies at the same time, this is going to be a global problem. And if it's a problem in South Korea, Iran, and Italy, it's going to be a problem everywhere, and we're just not prepared for it. And I remember talking a lot with the Treasurer that evening about the potential implications of this, and I said, this is going to come to Australia, and it's going to be a very big deal. And I wondered at the time whether our democracies would be able to lock down in the way we'd seen in China. I think many of us kind of wondered whether our population would accept that. Yet we have, and we've done the right thing. So that was the scariest time I remember in the whole episode.
Got organised.
It was very clear within a couple of weeks that the government, the Reserve Bank, the regulators, the banks, the landlords would all need to be part of the solution. And I think, to Australia's credit, we managed that very well, and we did it very quickly. We all had to change long-standing positions. I mean, it wasn't easy for the government to give up on its commitment to surplus. It wasn't easy for us to cut interest rates down to zero. I don't think it's been easy for the banks to tell people they can have a mortgage deferral for 6 months plus maybe another four. So none of these things have been easy, but
the regulators
and the
regulators
had to give up on a lot of things. So there's a lot of stuff that had to happen, and it wasn't like months of policy deliberation. We had a few meetings where we decided, well, look, this is serious, we need to act quickly, decisively, and in the national interest, and the political class and the regulators did that, to their credit.
Can I ask you a question about modern monetary theory and why it's attracting so much comment in the US? And I know that you've expressed grave concerns and you responded with comments like there's no such thing as a free lunch. I think someone else has said that at some other point in history as well. Why is it getting the traction it is in the US, and why don't you like it?
I don't know why it's attracting so much attention in the US. There are a lot of other political factors at play there, which I won't comment on. It's called modern monetary theory, but there's actually not much monetary and not much modern and not much theory in it. But anyway, it's really a... you did ask me. So, I mean, it's really a theory about, or a series of propositions about fiscal policy. And the first proposition is the government should just keep spending until it achieves its objectives, whether they be full employment or equality or inflation. So the government should just keep doing what it does till it achieves its objectives. And the second proposition is that it shouldn't worry about financing when it's doing that. If you've got a central bank there, you can go to the central bank and ask it to print money to finance, and you can achieve your objectives. So it's really about fiscal policy. I think there are kind of a large list of kind of potential problems with it. The first is that it assumes that government policy can, just by kind of being dialed up and down, can kind of get the economy and the society exactly where the government wants it. The history of that is not particularly encouraging, to think that kind of fiscal and government policy can be used in such a fine-tuned way. It also assumes that the political system can deal with the inflation threat. The central bank financing can be just turned on and off to achieve the government's objectives. The history there is not that good. The reason why we have independent central banks is because when, in the past, politicians have been effectively determining the policy of the central bank, it's always led to too much inflation. And once inflation gets in the system, it's very hard to control. I think the third observation I always make is some proponents of modern monetary theory do think it's kind of some free lunch. As I said, it's a free lunch. It kind of we just go to the central bank. After all, they make the money. If you just give it to the government, they can spend it and everyone's better off. The reality, though, is even if the central bank finances in the short run, someone ultimately has to pay, and they have to pay through higher taxes. They either pay through the inflation tax or taxes because you need to recapitalise the central bank, because you can't have a central bank indefinitely having negative capital, or the spending's paid for by taxes on the banking system through the banks being forced to hold reserves at the central bank at zero interest rate when the market interest rate's higher. So someone always pays. And I think it's attractive to some people because they don't kind of see all the multiple linkages down the track where someone pays. In the instant that you print the money, no one pays. It seems free. The central bank just creates the money, doesn't it? But someone always pays.
That's the thing.
And they always pay in terms of higher taxes. If the government spends money, it's paid for by higher taxes by someone at some point. There are situations at the moment where it makes perfect sense to borrow against future income, against future taxes, to smooth the economic shock. We're in a once-in-a-century pandemic, and I think it makes sense the government to use its balance sheet to smooth that out. But as a general proposition, kind of the government just continuing to borrow to achieve its objectives doesn't make sense. It just leads to inflation or taxes.
Well, I think that is clear. That's the death of modern monetary theory. Thank you. Thank you, Governor.
Some people don't just look at the free lunch and think,
it's just a few New York bestsellers that have got enthusiastic about it, but it's good that we've got that very clear. This is an interesting one. You are occasionally asked if there's a time when you can see that you will be taking interest rates negative. And your current view is that's not happening and you don't see that happening, at least in the foreseeable future. So this question's a bit pointy. It asks, what would it take for you to get to that position?
Well, we've said repeatedly that it's extraordinarily unlikely, and obviously that's still the position we hold. And the reason we say that is, I think if we have negative interest rates, there are clear costs in terms of the supply of credit. It makes it harder for banks to lend. And we're also seeing evidence in Europe that when interest rates are negative, some people actually decide to save more rather than to spend more. Lower interest rates are supposed to encourage people to spend. But if you're getting negative rates on your deposits, some people say, well, that's terrible. I've got better start saving more because the money I'm in the bank is worth less every day. So it affects the supply of credit and maybe has perverse effects on spending. So they're the negatives. The only upside I can see is it would put downward pressure on our currency. If our interest rates were negative and no one else in the world had negative rates, then people would want to hold Australian dollar assets and the currency would come down. So a weaker currency would be the benefit, but the costs outweigh that benefit. So you asked under what circumstances would we rethink this. I think the only case where we'd be rethinking it is if the world's major central banks, all the major central banks, decide to set their interest rates at negative territory. Because imagine, for the sake of argument, the Federal Reserve, it was minus 50 basis points or 1 percentage point, and we sat there with higher interest rates, and we're still in the world we're in now. The current Australian dollar would be incredibly attractive. Capital would flow here, the currency would go up, and it'd be harder to create jobs. So that's the only circumstance that we would think about it. And it's extraordinarily unlikely because most of the major central banks that have their interest rates in positive territory say they want to keep it that way, and so do we, because we're looking at the evidence on credit supply and the spending response, and think it just probably doesn't work.
Yep. So that's one thing we're not going to lead the world on.
No, we are not. No. We are not going to lead the world on negative rates, I can assure you of that.
Okay, I've got it. I've got a very, very highly voted on question here. How do you rank women's return to work supported by quality early learning and childcare as critical for economic growth? I think the question should be, do you rank? And if so, how important do you think it is?
Well, I think it's very important. I know the International Monetary Fund and the OECD in Paris have done studies looking at what are the most productive investments that societies can make, and it's investing in early child education. So that's what the evidence says. And I was on a call earlier today with people from the International Monetary Fund. They're saying that one of the things they're worried about is that over the past 6 months, many young kids haven't had the normal education they would get. And they worry about the long-term implications of that, because we know that if kids miss out on education, probably up to year seven, it can have long-term effects on their learning and their career prospects. So that's a significant issue. It's not my area of expertise. I'm just relaying what I hear from the experts, that of the various investments that we can make at the moment, making sure that the people who've missed out on education over the COVID period catch up quickly is probably one of the best investments we can make.
Well, I think that's why it was such a popular question, and I think your answer will be the most popular answer. Okay, got a few more here, if we're going okay for time, Megan. All right, given the prediction of zero population growth for Australia, I don't think that was your prediction as such, but take that as a premise.
Yep.
Do you believe there are lessons we can learn from other countries which have found themselves in a similar situation? Japan, Ireland, for example.
Well, I would hope that population growth of 0.2% this year is an aberration, and that we go back to faster population growth. I think on almost any metric, Australia is the great successful immigrant country after World War II. We've made ourselves a prosperous, wealthy, dynamic country through immigration, or partly through immigration. I would be disappointed if we lost that. And so I don't think we're going to go back to a world where population growth is very, very low. If we do, then lots of things are going to have to change. If population growth is at 1.5% less than it's been, so many things in our society are going to be different. I view the benefits of fast population growth as far outweighing the negatives. So I think we would lose something if we don't go back to being a great immigrant country.
So the lesson is to get our immigration back to where we'd like it to be.
Well, we can't even get Australians who want to come back, let alone citizens of the world who want to come and live in our great country. We can't do that. So we've got to find the time to do it.
And I think if we can get back to fairly fast population growth, we'll be better off over time.
Okay, well, I think we're coming up for last couple of questions. This one is a comparative question. It's asking you to compare your decision-making with that of the Feds in the US. And it asks, the Fed seems to consider the US stock market in all its decisions as part of its financial stability aim. To what extent does the RBA factor in what's happening in the Australian share market in your decision-making?
I don't want to comment on how the Fed approaches it, but the stock market really only influences our decision-making very, very indirectly, and that's largely through the wealth and confidence effects that comes from movements in equity prices. If the equity prices go up, then people might feel a bit more wealthy and they spend a bit, and we've got models that kind of give us some rough numbers of how to do it. So that's the only way the stock market influences our decision-making. Our interest rate decisions have never been driven by movements in the ASX or equity prices. Our interest rate decisions are driven by jobs and prices, not what's going on in the equity market. The equity market can indirectly affect that, but it's very indirect. They're much more important and more direct effects.
So my very last question here has just come in. This quotes you and something you said at Citi's ANZ conference recently. You said that the Australian economy will see a period of heightened structural change. What are the specific changes you'd like to see? And what would you like to see business and government's role in those changes?
What I would like to see is a little different to what might actually happen. I think we've talked about some of the structural changes that are going on. It's population growth, that's quite different. Digitalisation, I see that as a world of opportunity. We're seeing changes in how people spend their money. One of the things that's kept the economy afloat is that people with income and resources actually spend their money on different things. So we mightn't be able to, if you live in Sydney, you haven't been able to go up on a holiday to Cairns, but maybe you can go to kind of Coffs Harbour or somewhere else, or you can do some renovations, or you can buy that stuff for your house, and it's pushed homewares prices up, they talked about before. So there's a huge amount of substitution going on, and that's affecting the opportunities that businesses have. So there's a lot of structural change going on there. In the property market, talked about regional housing prices being stronger than the cities as people kind of move out of the cities. There's a change in the relative price of apartments and houses, as people value houses more than apartments when you've got to live there kind of and live and work at home. So there are all these structural things going on. I think over time, there's a strong merit in the government refocusing on the structural reforms that would lead to Australia to be a great place for businesses to invest, hire, expand and innovate. Now, there's a long list of government reports telling us how to do that. And when the politicians ask me at the public hearings what they should do, I say, read the reports. Because there's an endless list of reports. We know the areas: labour market, taxation, planning, research and development, human capital, early childhood, education. So there's energy. So we know the areas to kind of have further structural reforms in to make Australia an even better place for businesses to expand, innovate, hire people and invest. So the good news is there's no shortage of ideas.